week of August 19th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 420, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey, Sperling.
You're back in Birmingham.
I am indeed. I'll be here for another about 10 days, and then, I'm going to Atlanta for a few days, and then I'll be back here, and then back to New York. I've got Labor Day weekend. I'm going to go to the U.S. Open Tennis. I'm going to go to the New York Film Festival, I hope, if I get approved. And then I'm driving out to Colorado.
I have no idea why you would be driving. Oh, Telluride? No.
Nope. I'm just taking my nephew. My nephew is joining a snowboarding team, and I'm helping him drive out. He's moving in on October 1st, joining the team, and I'm just taking him out there.
That sounds like a made-up story.
It's absolutely true. What's a made-up story is the idea that GoWatchIt.com is everything you want. Now, let me say, first of all, you were touting GoWatchIt.com. I remember a few years ago checking it out and not being happy with it. It's cool. It's very hard to get all the data for all the things going on in the world. Everybody, every major studio, every cable company, everyone wants to create the portal for your home, the one place you start to find out everything. You know, you shouldn't have to know whether...
By everything, we mean like, hey, we want you to come to us and we'll tell you where all the movies are, where all the TV shows are.
Or you can just click on it and immediately go to it, right? So you don't have to think, you don't have to know.
We've got it all.
They want to be the portal, right? So GoWatchIt is trying to do something that's really hard that everyone is tackling. But you mentioned it, you talked it up. I said, all right, I went to check it out again and I looked up Killing Eve, the BBC America show, the British show, hot show, one of the hotter shows of the last 6 months. If they're going to have information on current TV shows, it should certainly be Killing Eve. And what they basically offer is that they go to the four main sites, iTunes, Amazon, Google, and YouTube, and they'll tell you whether whatever you're looking for is available on them. And most things are. Most old movies, most TV shows, you're going to find them on most of them, if not all of them, available for digital download or rental or purchase on digital or, you know, Blu-ray or whatever. But it doesn't even tell you what they offer. It just says, oh, yeah, you can find it on Amazon, and then you have to click on it to find out what exactly is available. It doesn't say, oh, if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can get that for free. It doesn't tell you, oh, if you're a Hulu member, just go there and you can watch it for free right now. And it also has no information on TV listings. It doesn't say, yeah, oh, there's a marathon of Killing Eve this week on BBC America. And they wouldn't know for forever, but they should know for the next month. You've got TV listings going ahead of a month. At least the next 4 weeks, you can go on your TV right now and scroll ahead for a month. So if I'm looking for Casablanca and I type it in, I want my portal to say it's showing on Turner Classic Movies Thursday at 2 p.m. That's what I want. That's reasonable. Killing Eve, maybe there's a marathon on Saturday from noon to 8 p.m. Maybe it's airing every Monday night at 10 p.m. That should be on there. If it's not, to me, that's just not doing it yet. And that's what I found when I looked up Killing Eve.
Well, yeah, what I can say is they are not a TV guide, so as you've pointed out.
So they're useless. They are a TV guide because they have lots of TV shows on there. They are a TV guide. They're not a guide to what's on TV. They're like, yes, you can look up old TV shows and movies just like you can on Amazon, but they don't even tell you, you know, what's available where, when, why, or how. Killing Eve is available on demand if you have cable. If they were going to do a good service, I would say you need to get the TV guide information because every channel's available, or even better, have people input what your cable service is. I'm on Comcast, I'm on DirecTV, I'm on this. And then they can specialize and provide it personalized information. But at the very least, if you're looking up Killing Eve, they should be able to tell you it's on BBC America on demand or when it's airing next on the TV.
Well, so like a couple points here. Better Call Saul, I'm just using it as an example.
Right.
You're right, they don't tell you when the new season starts or is on. They do tell you what seasons are available to rent or own.
Yes. That's what I already said. You can find out what's available to rent or own on the four basic services.
This is where I was headed. Subscription-wise, they do actually tell you that Amazon Prime, Netflix, DirecTV, Hulu, if you can stream it on those services. And movies are the same, but you're right.
It's not available on all those services. What are you talking about?
Better Call Saul is available on Netflix.
To rent or own, yes.
No. Available in HD, included with subscription.
Yes, but what seasons? Not the current season.
No, of course not.
Well, what do you mean, of course not? I want to know where I can watch the new episodes of Better Call Saul. I want to know I can go to AMC. Maybe it's on Hulu the next day. Maybe it's on something, you know, that's what I want to know. I want to know where it's at. T- telling me that it's available to buy on Amazon and Google. Well, of course it is. Virtually everything is available for sale on iTunes and Amazon. So that's meaningless information. I'm sorry. I just don't think it's even remotely complete enough.
Well, I use it when I want to find out if a movie is, or even sometimes a TV show, but mostly movies, are available for streaming on Amazon Prime, on Netflix, for streaming purposes. So, for instance, I wanted to find out if It Happened One Night was available for streaming. And what I found out is it pretty much wasn't, if I am not mistaken.
I'm telling you, it's just not complete. It's not remotely complete. If you're offering TV shows and movies, I'm looking at Better Call Saul. I want to know where the episodes are airing. I don't think that's unreasonable. Go watch it now. It's not called go watch it 6 months after the episodes aired. It's called go watch it now.
No, it's called go watch it, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go watch it. Go watch it. Well, I want to see the new episodes of Better Call Saul.
And I'd like to correct myself. Apparently, It Happened One Night, the 1934 version with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, is available for streaming on Filmstruck. And, of course, you could buy it on Blu-ray and DVD and rent it.
You can buy it everywhere, yeah. Right. Yeah. But it's also airing on TV tomorrow, but you wouldn't know that because it doesn't have that information.
It does not have that information, no.
Right. Well, why not? That's not a good system. It's not good enough. That's all I want to say.
Okay.
You're happy with it? Great. It doesn't have most information on most things, but that's all right.
I don't know. Well, let us know what you think about GoWatchIt.com. Now, I would imagine that a lot of this is U.S.-centric, but if you do live in the U.S. and you happen to go to GoWatchIt.com, let us know what you think. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. That's 888-567-SAND, 888-567-7263. Or you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox.
GoListenToIt.com. That's what I want to know, because when they're listening to the episode this week, what will they hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we wondered, actually, what if we held a podcast and no stories turned up? None at all. So, yes, apparently, all the newsmakers in the entertainment world are off to France for their August holidays or wherever they happen to go. But that won't stop us from talking. As you can see, we just spent like 20 minutes on GoWatchIt.com. In China news, it's rumored the actress Fan Bingbing is banned from acting for 3 years. Hey, that's better than being in the film I, Partment, which had a second weekend collapse of historic proportions. You know, iPartment, the latest version, by the way, it doesn't have doorknobs, actually. It just uses Bluetooth to open the doors.
Okay.
So it's like the latest version of the iPhone has no headphone jack.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. Meanwhile, MoviePass continues to mess with the minds of its users, and investors are not happy about it. They're suing the company's owners for tanking the stock.
We'll take MoviePass. It's just not that into you.
Yeah. And you're probably not that into it anymore either. We'll take a closer look at the music industry paper put out by Citigroup last week. A lot of industry players were very unhappy, and their reasons are pretty convincing. In Book Filter News, Michael will head back in time to tell the story of Sarah Bernhardt, one of the most famous stage actresses of her era, and the woman who wiped the floor with her. In sexual misconduct news, Asa Argento is making news for all the wrong reasons. On Inside Baseball, we take a closer look at the publishing industry, all of the publishing industry. So if you want to know what that means, stick around. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, whatever they might be. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And I think it's going to be some rich news this week.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you, our listeners. And to make the charts at all for our list, you had to gross $5 million. That's where you'll find Slenderman at number 23, the bottom of our chart. $5 million on the weekend, $20 million so far for that horror flick about scary pasta. If you wanted to hit the top 10, you needed to gross about $16 million. That's where you'll find Disney's Christopher Robin, $16 million on the weekend, $90 million worldwide. So pretty modest, slow goings for Christopher Robin. Well, probably he's not going to have a good story to tell when all is said and done. Somebody give him some honey to cheer him up. And number one around the world, however, is The Meg for a second weekend in a row. $88 million on the weekend, $314 million worldwide. It's made about $115 million of that in China alone. That's its biggest market. So having all those Chinese actors and Chinese locations really paid off for the movie. They're made about $83 million in North America. So, you know, leaning China certainly paid off. It's still got a little ways to go, but this movie is going to triple its budget of $130 million. It's already at $315 million. So it's going to be fine when all is said and done. Decades in the making for that movie, a big shark eating people. You'd think it would have been easier to make, but when they finally did it, they're going to make green.
Well, and you'd think, like, you know, come on, it's a movie that's been made before. So why did it take decades to make?
I don't know. And number two around the world is The Island. This is the Chinese comedy about office workers who are stranded on an island. $38 million this weekend, $165 million worldwide. And number three, Adam Sandler's having a good weekend. Hotel Transylvania 3 opened up in some more territories. $32 million on the weekend. That's at $425 million worldwide.
So all those people making fun of him for like going to sign a Netflix deal and not working with Sony, and how Amy Pascal was, you know, kind of making fun of him, you know, about, oh, we'll have to make another Adam Sandler movie. I can't believe we have to work with it. And he's like, okay, so should I take my $500 million and go home, or how do you want to work this?
No, he's, you know, of course, this is an animated film. So some people might say, well,
it's not really his movie.
Right. It's not true. I think he is a big draw in the movie and is a big draw as a name for people going to the film and the sensibility around it. So I still think that's pretty notable. But if we look at the three films, this is probably going to be the highest grossing yet. The first one made $380 million worldwide. The second made $470 million worldwide. It looks like this one could top that off. So just like The Purge, each Hotel Transylvania film has made more than the one before. At number four, what would, you know, and if he can turn that into another live action hit on the big screen, that'd be great. Except Netflix signed him up for more movies, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be working for Netflix.
They said, we're happy. Keep him coming.
Yeah, for the rest of his life, he's working for Netflix.
Well, Tom Cruise is going to be working in the movies for the rest of his life, too. He's a star. Mission Impossible Fallout, $31 million on the weekend, $500 million worldwide. It looks like it might fall short. I don't know what, if it has any big territories left to open up. But, you know, the last two made about $700 million. That's where they certainly wanted to hit. They're going to be okay. They're certainly going to make their money back. But it may be a little bit lower than the last few.
You know what MoviePass would say? This week, you know, MoviePass would say, hey, if we had more money, you would have hit your $700 million.
And the big news of the week is way down at number five because it opened up mostly in North America, a few other small territories. It's Crazy Rich Asians, $26 million on the weekend, $35 million worldwide. It costs $30 million to make. It's the first Hollywood film with an all westernized Asian cast since The Joy Luck Club decades ago. That movie was a moneymaker. It cost $10 million to make, and it made about $30 million at the U.S. box office. It doesn't seem to have been released overseas, which makes no sense, but I couldn't find any overseas numbers for it. Crazy Rich Asians is just starting out in North America. It only made about $700,000 in the other six territories. We can only assume it will do very well in the Asian markets, though it doesn't have a Chinese release date yet, does it?
No, and I wonder if it ever will.
Well, why wouldn't it?
Well,
they want it. They want it. It's just rich people. What's wrong? Oh, you think? I think they'd be happy. I don't know. It sort of says money doesn't matter. You know, they have movies with wealthy rich people in China.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry about that. I saw it was the only movie I could see on Sunday. You know, MoviePass said you can see one film, Crazy Rich Asians. That was it. So I went. It was harmless. though our in-house movie critic, Aaron Rich thought it was fun. Yeah, he said, it's fun. He liked it. He didn't think it was, you know, great, but he said it was enjoyable. And one of the actresses was very funny, playing one of her best pals. He liked her a lot. And I have to say, the male lead, Grant Harding, is a little controversial because he's half white, I believe, or he's a British actor. He's not, you know, Chinese, pure 100% Chinese. And
he's Malaysian, actually.
Yes, but his parents are mixed race. He's mixed race.
All right.
He's absolutely mixed race because they talked about it at length in the New York Times and how that was a little controversial and they thought about it seriously. They just felt like the actor was so perfect for the role. And the guy, the director, the screenwriter said, not the screenwriter, the author of the novel.
Yeah.
Said, hey, I grew up in Singapore. There's lots of mixed race people. And that whole argument about who's authentically Asian and not, that's part of the movie's discussion. I feel like that's crazy. And he's a wonderful actor, and we thought he was perfect for the role. And I have to admit, he's awfully charismatic.
Yeah.
So $35 million on the weekend. So an excellent start for Crazy Rich Asians from just one territory. Will it get a Chinese release? We'll be paying attention. At number six, The Equalizer 2. I spoke too soon again. Clearly, the Denzel Washington movie opened up in some new territories, $20 million on the weekend. So that's at $123 million worldwide. Maybe he'll claw his way up to $180 million. He could do it. It made about $100 million in North America, and now it's grossed $30 million overseas. But that's a strong weekend for The Equalizer 2. Not such a strong weekend for Europe Raiders. This is a Hong Kong action comedy. It's the third in a series after Tokyo Raiders and Seoul Raiders, which I guess means New York Raiders will be the fourth film. It made $19 million on its opening weekend, which is fine. We don't know the budget, but it made almost all of that on Friday. Saturday and Sunday, it fell off a cliff. So the people who saw it clearly were not happy with the film.
And then they told everybody about it on Twitter and Facebook.
That's right. And number eight is the ABBA film, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. $18 million on the weekend, $320 million worldwide. Here's a movie that had a better hold in China. It's Go, Brother. It's a Chinese flick in which a sister wishes her annoying older brother would just go away, and she magically somehow sends him to be a member of another family. And that's when she realizes her older brother, who seems so annoying, was actually protecting her from her parents divorcing and fighting all the time and always had her best interests in heart. So it's a heartwarming tale, much like, what are those movies called? Vice Versa and
Freaky Friday.
That's the one I was trying to think of. So it made $17 million on its opening weekend. So it made less than Europe Raiders, but it held steady all weekend long. So every day people went, they were happy, the numbers held steady. So that's a good sign. You know, that's what we've done. We've gone from tracking movies 1 week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks and deciding how well it's doing. We're doing it hour by hour. Oh, the 5 p.m. screening fell off a cliff. That means people hated it at 2 p.m., you know? So movies really live and die very quickly these days, thanks to social media and the information we have at the flick of our fingers. At number 11, another Chinese film. It's Oolong Courtyard Kung Fu School. It's a broad comedy about two would-be thieves trying to steal a jewel from a kung fu school filled with crazy monks. Hijinks ensue. $14 million on its opening weekend. Mark Wahlberg had a not great weekend. His new action film, Mile 22, directed by Peter Berg. They've made a lot of movies together. This one opened to $14 million and pretty poor reviews. So the legs probably won't be great. He'll have to hope he does better overseas. The Incredibles 2 is certainly doing well everywhere. Another $11 million this weekend, $1,121 million worldwide. Then there's Alpha from one of the Hughes brothers, right? This is a film directed by one of the Hughes brothers. It's about
Albert Hughes.
Albert Hughes, about a prehistoric boy and his dog, or his wolf, I guess. It made $10 million on its opening weekend, and for some reason, I kind of want to see it.
It's supposed to be quite good.
Well, it didn't get great reviews, but it sounds sort of interesting. I don't know why, but if MoviePass will let me go, maybe I will.
Well, apparently it was the only movie I could see, so.
Well, Black Klansman was one of the movies I saw a few days ago, thanks to MoviePass. $8 million this weekend, $24 million worldwide, most of it in North America. So it had a solid second weekend. It's certainly one of his best performing movies in a long time at the box office. I thought it was fun.
You want to know something interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Black Klansman, okay, millennial females and millennial males, 18 to 30 years old, okay, in North America. That was one of the top three movies that they wanted to see this past weekend, Black Klansman. But then
the second weekend, you mean?
The second weekend, yes. But then when you get to Gen X and above, that it totally falls off the charts. And it's in the films, you know, 5 through 20.
You mean so he's reaching younger people, not older people?
Yeah, but what I would say is Spike Lee's film, Black Klansman, it's the political nature of it, I think, that is actually the draw there.
Appealing to younger people. I'm surprised, since you would expect him to have a pull for older audiences who have, you know, watched his films for decades now, ever since, you know, She's Gotta Have It and Do the Right Thing and on all that. So I'm a little surprised that it doesn't skew a bit older. But it was certainly worthwhile. I found it enjoyable. there are didactic flaws to it. But the fun thing was the sidewalk shot, the famous shot that he has in every movie where people are floating along a sidewalk, sort of. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. He calls it the there's an actual term for that. But
I forget what he called it. I call it the sidewalk shot. People kind of cheered when that shot happened. It was like a Hitchcock cameo. They're like, yay, sidewalk shot.
They did that when the film screened in Cannes and that shot happened. Oh, hilarious. Yeah, they were like, oh, yeah, there you go. It's like a Spike Lee characteristic. Joint. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it happened at a good moment in the film, too. So it was kind of a nice release moment. Speaking of demographics, Crazy Rich Asians, 40% of the opening weekend audience was Asian. That's in North America. That's amazing. Those people said, we are going to see this movie.
Yes.
And I'm thinking it was probably weighted a little bit towards women, obviously weighted towards Asian Americans and Asian people. And I'm thinking the word of mouth will be good. I think it's a commercial film, and I think it's going to have pretty good legs. I think this is not a movie that's just playing to that audience. It's playing to everybody. It's a broad and, you know, friendly comedy, romantic comedy. It's the first romantic comedy. It opened the biggest romantic comedy in like 3 years and the biggest adult comedy of the year. You know, so these are $35 million. We get so inured to $100 million openings and $80 million openings and $200 million openings. For a movie of this budget and this type of genre, which I normally don't like to focus in on, an opening is an opening. But hey, romantic comedies have been struggling a little bit, and this movie has really injected some commercial energy into it. And people said, oh, they've saved it by getting diverse. That's what always happens. Remember the sitcom in the 80s? Idiotically, some people said, oh, the sitcom is dead. Nobody wants to see sitcom. They literally thought nobody would go see a sitcom anymore on TV. Well, it's over with. They're done. Never going to happen again. Never going to be a big deal. And then along came The Cosby Show.
Well,
genre is ever dead, but, you know.
But as far as demographics go, Crazy Rich Asians by 24%, but in almost every single female category from millennial, Gen X, 50 plus.
What else are they going to see? Of course.
Yeah.
There's nothing. You know, they also marketed it well. They opened it in August, away from a lot of other movies. It's usually a dead period, but they knew they'd get that core audience of Asian Americans coming out. They wanted to support this movie. They knew it had been weeks since there'd been another romantic comedy. Probably Overboard was the last big romantic comedy. Weeks or months. They knew there was not any big movie. It was the second weekend of The Meg, so that wasn't a big risk. So they really protected the film. They marketed it well. They reached their core audience, and now we'll have to see if it has legs.
Do you want to hear an interesting demographic statistic for this past weekend? Okay, so millennial females, right? 18 to 30 years old, 23.5% went Crazy Rich Asians, went to see Crazy Rich Asians. But the male demographic for that was 14.8%, okay? Now, 18 to 30-year-olds, you know, they might be single, they might be coupled up and taking their boyfriends with them. Now,
Or husbands, yes.
Skip all the way down to 50-plus females and males. 23.9% went to see Crazy Rich Asians 50-plus. For males, that was 18.5%. So it went up. So you can see that, like, that there's more...
Men don't get dragged to the movies with their girlfriends and wives.
Right. Well, more so when they're older.
Yeah, of course. You're in a relationship. Right. Or you say, hey, I want my wife to see Grant Harding, and then she'll be in a happier mood for the rest of the day.
Right. Am I kind of pointing out the obvious here? Is that... Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, you are. But okay. You love your numbers.
Yes, I do. I love my numbers.
Ant-Man at the Wasp is at $465 million worldwide. Then we have a new movie, Gintama 2, or Gintama 2. I'm not sure how to say that. This is a live-action flick. It's a sequel spun off from a manga, which also spun off some animated films. It's about a ragtag team fighting to protect a shogun. I believe their time traveling is involved. $7.3 million on its opening weekend. Right below that is a Korean film. This is called The Witness, and it's about a man in an apartment building who witnesses a murder. And he decides to just mind his own business. Unfortunately, the murderer saw him. So his life gets a little tricky. And scrolling down, I think that's it. Well, Hello, Mr. Billionaire, still chugging along, $360 million worldwide.
In one territory.
And it's not North America. That's amazing. That's how big the Chinese market is. But one movie, you know, Crazy Rich Asians was the big story this week, but the second biggest story was a movie that's not on the list.
Yes,
I'm not talking about Kevin Spacey.
Oh, I thought you for sure were going to mention that Kevin Spacey's latest film opened up to a whopping $618. It's The Billionaire Boys Club.
Right, but there were 9 movies this week that made less than $1,000. When you open up on one screen or two screens and it's just a contractual obligation or you're a small film, happens all the time. This movie's been available for video on demand for a month.
Oh, okay.
Not a movie. They're just dumping it. They didn't market it. They didn't sell it. It's on one screen probably. I don't even know what city it's in because it's not on most charts. So it wasn't on, you know, it was hard to find out where it was playing at all. But this is not unusual. It happens all the time. Usually with smaller films, but this is a small film. It's not a successful movie. I mean, Ansel Elgort is in it. The guy from Kingsman is in it. So there's big names. It's not just Kevin Spacey, but people got all excited because it was Kevin Spacey. And they thought, oh, look, they're rejecting his movies. But yeah, I wasn't talking about that movie. Because it's just a thing that happens if you pay attention to the charts. But I'm talking about Ethan Hawke. He had 2 movies opening this weekend. You know, he's already got First Reformed, the Paul Schrader film, which I saw was quite impressive. An interesting, solid movie. He also stars in Juliet Naked, a new romantic comedy based on the novel by what's his name? High Fidelity, Nick Hornby.
Nick Hornby.
And he also directed a film that came from Sundance, the music biopic Blaze. So he's been in a Paul Schrader film, he stars in a romantic comedy, and he's directing a music biopic, which got great reviews at Sundance. So a heck of a week for Ethan Hawke.
But I actually saw Juliet Naked, and it's quite fun. I mean, it's kind of what you would expect, but it's speaking of romantic comedies, it's more of like a romantic dramedy. In which you know, an epistolary relationship turns into, you know, a real life relationship where Ethan Hawke
plays a cult musical star, you know, a star from, you know, indie rock. And how was his singing?
Actually, he, you know, that was like the big, you know, would he or would he not sing, right? That was going to be the question, because he plays like a former you know, a rocker from like the 1990s the Rose Byrne's character, her husband is, or her boyfriend is really just infatuated with, and somehow they start a relationship, and his singing is good. To answer your question, he sang Waterloo Station, and it was quite good.
But will it be as good as Bradley Cooper?
Oh, I probably not, actually.
Maybe we do. Why are you saying that?
Because I've seen parts of that film, A Star Is Born, and he does a pretty darn good job, that Bradley Cooper.
All right. Well, the movie I wanted to talk about was none of those. It was iPartment. We talked about this movie last week. This is the iPhone, you know, new domicile, the Apple domicile. No. It's a Chinese sitcom called iPartment, which is a takeoff on Friends and shows like that. Then they made a movie. It used the same title, but I was wrong here. It has none of the same actors, though apparently they're sort of the characters, but they're plopped into this Tomb Raider comedy. It has nothing to do with the TV show. None of the actors appear in the movie. The studio was accused of buying $15 million of ticket to boost up the opening weekend box office. They've reduced the amount of opening weekend. First, they said it made $80 million. Now they're saying it just made $70 million opening weekend last week. Everybody was outraged. Talk about falling off a cliff. We talked about some movies that, you know, dropped steeply Friday to Saturday and Sunday. Well, this movie, it may have made $70 million last weekend. This weekend, it made $800,000.
Wow.
It dropped 99.9%. I mean, it's easy to make no money when you open up on one screen and nobody markets your movie like Billionaire's Boys Club. But when you open to $70 million and the next weekend, literally you can count the people who went to your movie on one hand. That is unbelievable. That's insane. People hated this movie. I tried. I could not find an example because it's really hard. You're looking for movies that are on the charts one week and drop off completely the next. I couldn't find any example of a movie that opened that big and dropped that hard on its second. I mean, that's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, 99%? The movie was released for only 1 week.
No. It made $800,000 on its second week. Why would you pull it except people aren't going? It averaged $18 million a day on its opening weekend, and then it averaged $250,000 a day on the second weekend. I mean, that's,
you know,
just...
You know what they need, though? What would have helped boost that film's second weekend profits? MoviePass would have helped.
It would have helped a lot.
It would have been the only movie you could see that weekend, but it would have helped.
That's true. Or maybe Fan Bing Bing. We hear that Fan Bing Bing is perhaps banned from acting for several years. She's an actress in China. She is under investigation for potential tax fraud. There's a rumor that she's not allowed to leave the country while this tax investigation is ongoing. It's a big, big story in the Middle Kingdom. And now there's rumors that she's not even going to be allowed to act in a movie for several years. So we'll have to find out if there's any truth to that. It is just a rumor, but that's how seriously this story is building. But we were talking about movies in the U.S. and North America. Fun fact, this is completely out of the blue, nowhere, but out of the top 100 grossing movies of 2017, and we're talking about North America here, only 10 of them were shot in California.
Okay.
That sounds like a significant drop. I mean, that sounds a little amazing to me. I would not have guessed it was that low these days, but I guess movies are being shot all over the world. When you do Avengers, you're not shooting in LA, are you?
No, you're probably shooting, well, you're shooting all over the place, really.
Right. Yeah, so I wonder, but yeah, is that's not concerning, that's not unusual, that doesn't strike you as a bizarre figure, that's not some one-off confusion. Obviously, a lot of TV is shot in L.A., and you know,
I'd need to know, like, where those what they're considering being shot in Los Angeles. You know, like, is it 10% is shot in Los Angeles, 100% of it is shot in Los Angeles? I'd need to know, or California, I'd need to know what qualified as being shot in California.
It said California lagged behind Canada, the state of Georgia, and the UK in attracting film production. So this is according to Film LA, reported on Wednesday, as it issued its 2017 feature film studying. And as all that money was spent, the organization, the official film office of the city and county of LA, found that the features, whose budgets range from $4.5 million to more than $300 million, spend half of their production budgets in the U.S. That's of the top 100 grossing movies at the North American box office. That was the lowest share for the U.S. since Film LA began its tracking just 5 years ago.
Well, so, and Canada, remember, Film LA has an agenda, okay? They're trying to get more tax incentives passed. Right. So they have an incentive to say, oh, things are tough. Things are tough. So, you know, you always have to look at who's giving you the numbers and why.
That's right. They say that Canada had 20 films, the UK had 15, Georgia had 15 projects, followed by California with 10, and New York with 6. While New York is the second-ranked production center in the U.S., it was not able to carve out a significant share of the top 100 films. Obviously, again, New York is doing well with TV.
Right.
A dozen U.S. states, 20 nations spread across Europe, South America, Africa, Asia, and Australia. So what we want to know is, do they not count it if you don't receive – it can't be 100% of your movie, because most movies don't shoot in one location, period, especially the bigger budget you are.
I have no idea.
Right. Of those six – and here comes their agenda. Of the 6 live-action movies shot in L.A. – because, you know, 4 of them were animated, 6 were live action, but they were on the lower end of the scale, and 4 of those did not shot in the state despite not receiving tax credit. So most of the movies that shot in LA did not, the live action films did not get a tax credit. That's The House, Home Again, Lady Bird, and The Disaster Artist.
Right, and what they're trying to say there is, gee, imagine what would happen if you got a tax credit. Would people be going to Georgia? Maybe not.
And they say the only reason they're getting those movies is because you know, the tax incentives in other states aren't enough to attract movies with small budgets. You're right. Not going to grab the Lady Bird. They're not going to grab the Disaster Artist because there aren't big enough for them to worry about.
Correct.
Hmm. All right. But then there is also, of course, post-production. That's a lot big part of the budget. And you would think that would work, but they're claiming Canada's done a lot to invest in post-production work, including visual effects.
Yes, especially Sony ImageWorks is all in Vancouver now.
Yeah, well, so that's a big chunk of that budget going there. There you go. Well, so that was more interesting than I thought.
I should say maybe Sony Animation. I can't remember whether it's ImageWorks or Animation, but something Sony related is up there in Vancouver.
Yeah, well, MoviePass at least got a little more clear this week. Now they're at least letting people see a week in advance. All right, here's what movies will be available on what days. Because previously, they're just sort of gaslighting you. You never knew what was going to be available. You'd check it at midnight, and it would show you every movie available. Then by the time theaters were about to open, they'd say, no. Only these showtimes and only these movies. Now they're saying, okay, here's your week. Here's the movies you can see day to day and which movie. So I knew on Friday that I was going to be able to see Crazy Rich Asians on Sunday. Not ideal, but at least it's a little better.
And where, I guess they have
it's foolish that you have to go to their website. You can't see this on the app. You can see what movies are available today on your app very easily, but you can't see what movies will be available week to, you know, day to day during the week. So that's dumb. They need to change that. But they had a big quarterly loss for the owners of MoviePass, the owners of that company. Their stock sank 99% in 1 month And now people are suing. They're like, you're tanking our stock. So they are suing the owners of MoviePass and saying you have not done your fiduciary duty. You've bought this company and bought into a business plan that is, you know, losing us all money, and we won't stand for it. So they now face a suit from shareholders.
Right. And they lost $126 million in the first half of this year. So yeah, they're not doing too good. And their stock price, I think, now is like 2 cents.
Tick, tick, tick. Well, last week we mentioned very briefly about a report on the music industry put out by Citigroup, and it got a fair amount of coverage in the industry press. And now we've had people with a chance to look at it more closely and respond to it. And I feel like we see this a lot, Sperling. I don't know the people who did this particular report, but I feel like the investor groups, sometimes they just swoop in and say, oh, we're going to do a story on the theater industry. We'll analyze them. And they don't really know how it works. They're not focused on it all the time. And they try to do a survey and analyze an entire industry segment of the entertainment industry, and they don't know their stuff. And so they get a lot of things wrong, or they just get confused, and they don't seem to really grasp the basics of the industry. Does that sound familiar to you, where people swoop in and they just don't know what they're talking about when it comes to movies or the exhibitor industry?
Well, does it sound familiar? I mean, I've participated in a number of panels and conference calls where investment groups like Citigroup are trying to pick the brains of industry experts or industry consultants and then go write these reports. Some are actually very valuable conference calls where, you know, it's really just for the analysts to get their information for themselves. And that those are nice calls. The calls where they're trying to put a report together, you kind of wonder like, okay, so you just spent an hour on the phone with like 20 people. Did you really learn anything?
And when you see the reports, do you think, yeah, you didn't get it?
In some cases you see the reports and you're like, wow, okay, I'm surprised. They must've done more work after we spoke.
All right. Well, here's what happened. The Citigroup put out the report, and the music industry has responded. There was an article in Rolling Stone and another article in Billboard talking about this report. The Rolling Stone article was just generic. It sort of just said, oh, here's this story. And basically, they said the good news is that the music industry has now accepted streaming as its revenue leader and is poised to adapt around that, with many analysts and experts expecting the business will streamline itself with rewrites of law, new royalty negotiations, mergers, acquisitions, and consolidations into something leaner, and finally, more lucrative for musicians. Well, that would be a nice change, but the bad news is that they say no one knows when that will be. So don't hold your breath, but that's what they think. They're thinking a lot of things need to change because we're switching to a streaming model. Well, that's certainly true, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But then when we look at what was done in the Citigroup report, people were less kind. Some people pointed out, for example, that the major companies cited and featured in the report never heard from analysts prior to the report being published, raising concerns about incentives and conflicts of interest. In fact, Citigroup has SiriusXM and Live Nation as clients, and those are the same two companies cited as drivers of consolidation in positive terms, meaning they said, we're looking at the industry and big winners might include SiriusXM and Live Nation. Sounds like a bit of a conflict of interest.
I'd say so, yes.
And then they said, the criticism said, multiple data points used to drive their arguments, the arguments of Citigroup, particularly around record contracts and licensing deals, either make sweeping generalizations or are inaccurate.
Well, then there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, you just have to discount the report.
Right. Well, or at least that section of it. One label exec said, quote, that 12% artist share would go up dramatically if radio were out of the equation. And that's a reference to the fact that the report said artists get back about 12% of revenue, which is a big increase from over like 10 years ago. So it's actually good news in terms of they're getting more. But that's another thing. This label exec went on to say that has nothing to do with middlemen cutting out the artists. It has to do with how the U.S., North Korea, and Iran are the only countries that don't pay performance royalties to recording artists on terrestrial radio. That's almost $15 billion of the $43 billion that they're sizing in the report. In other words, when a song gets played on the radio, money doesn't go to the recording artist. It'll go to the songwriter, but it doesn't go to, say, you know, Madonna. Well, a lot of times she has written the song or co-written it. But say Elvis. It doesn't go to Elvis because he didn't write most of his songs. It goes to the songwriters. So you can play an Elvis song on the radio, or you can play a song for Justin Bieber. If he didn't write the song, if he doesn't have co-writing credit, he doesn't get money when it's played on the radio. So that's a big difference from most of the world. And that's one reason why their royalties are lower than they should be. And finally, it says that indie artists and labels are concerned about Citi's conclusions that further industry consolidation will give artists a greater share of the revenue pie. That was the thing I was going to address in the Rolling Stone comments. That, oh, everything's going to streamline. There's going to be lots of mergers and consolidations, and it's really going to help artists. To which you go, really? Because that almost never works that way.
Yeah, it's usually the exact opposite. There's usually mergers and consolidations, and the creatives get screwed.
Exactly. So, yeah. So I felt there were some substantial complaints about the report. I think we say that a lot of times they swoop in to write something about the theater industry or the movie industry. And that doesn't make sense to me because you think someone would be devoted full time to covering a multi-billion dollar business like music. Why Citigroup wouldn't have someone who really knew their stuff, at least as well as we do. You know, it doesn't seem to be a very tall, high bar.
Well, every week, speaking of reports, you show up here on the show with a report of what books we should be reading. In fact, you do this every week over at bookfilter.com where you explain, you know, out of that week's releases, what books everybody should be paying attention to. Here at Showbiz Sandbox, you bring a book that's kind of ready for its close-up that might be ripe for adaptation. What have you got for us this week?
This week, I've got a book called Playing to the Gods by Peter Rader. It's a nonfiction book, sort of a dual biography, of two actresses from the turn of the last century. One of them is Sarah Bernhardt. Does the name ring a bell?
It actually does. Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
stage
Sarah
actor,
Bernhardt.
Singer, and yeah.
Exactly. I mean, Mark Twain loved her. Charlie Chaplin loved. I mean, lots of people saw Sarah Bernhardt. And what I didn't realize until I read this book was she was an incredible marketer. Her name was and face was on face cream and fans, and she merchandised herself and marketed herself. She branded the hell out of herself. She was a star in the biggest sense of the word. This book calls her the first celebrity, which is ridiculous because there's always somebody before. I can't tell you how many times I've read a book that said this person is the first celebrity, you know, that sort of thing. But she was very famous, known worldwide. She made headlines for all her personal life and all her scandalous ongoings. But she was a great marketer. Yeah, and that's why you'll see her mentioned in movies and, you know, TV shows. If they're set in that era, they'll might mention Sarah Bernhardt, or she might be seen on stage, things like that. Like The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, that movie starring Paul Newman. I think Sarah Bernhardt is mentioned in that film. So I knew that name. What I did not know the name of was Eleanor Duse. And she's an Italian actress. Sarah Bernhardt was French, and Eleanor Duse was an Italian actress. She was a little bit younger. She came up. Sarah Bernhardt was already a star, and she idolized her and thought she was wonderful. Sarah Bernhardt essentially was the last great star in the old mold. For a lot of history on stage, people would pose, I am angry. And they would hold their fist up in a particular way to indicate, I am angry. And they would declaim their line, talking to the audience, I am very furious at you. They didn't pretend there was a fourth wall. They didn't pretend that the audience wasn't there. They spoke to the audience and they posed, this is me swooning. This is me in romance. And they had particular poses detailed down to have the left knee pointed out, the right knee pointed in, pose here, stand here, declaim there. I mean, it was all very choreographed, going back to Greek tragedy and how theater was very ritualized. People didn't expect you to be acting the way we think of it today. Sarah Bernhardt was one of the last great people who did that style of acting. And she was basically a star. Didn't matter what role she did, it was Sarah Bernhardt from beginning to end. She winked at the audience. She nodded. They loved her. She was famous, beloved, and talented, clearly. Eleanor Duse was the first of the new breed. She's like the Marlon Brando of stage acting. She really revolutionized theater. And her name, Duse, is short for doozy. That became a nickname for her because she was such a Duse, such a unique person. And so doozy, when you say, wow, what a doozy, what a great, unique thing, that's because of Eleanor Duse. And she didn't think you should be doing any of that. She wanted to be as natural as possible. She pretended the audience wasn't there. She paused between lines. You could see her thinking. It was just, it was a thunderbolt. It was literally like Brando in Streetcar Named Desire. People couldn't believe what she was doing. They didn't understand it. The other actors didn't understand it. But eventually they got so moved and excited that she revolutionized acting. It was all before Eleanor Duse and then after Eleanor Duse. And so these two women started off as one admiring the other, became great rivals. You know, they're competing. And ultimately the book peaks with them appearing in London on stage across the street from each other in the same role. So every theater critic went to both shows to talk about them, and Sarah Bernhardt did not come off well. Everybody said that Eleanor Duse was the future of theater and acting. Basically, George Bernard Shaw was a critic at the time. He praised her, you know, but you know, just when the book feels like it's, you know, like an episode of Feud or that TV series, and you think, oh, let's be perfect because it's hilarious. They go see each other perform in this role. Eleanor Hughes leaps to her feet when Sarah Bernhardt comes on stage and applauds and applauds and then stays on her feet the entire time she's on stage. So, of course, everyone in the audience is watching Sarah Bernhardt and turning to look at Eleanor Hughes in the balcony standing up, right? Every time she comes on stage, she leaps to her feet in joy and appreciation so she can pull away attention from her. Sarah Bernhardt has a light installed in her seat so that when Eleanor Hughes comes on stage, Sarah Bernhardt is lit like an angel. And you can see her in the dark, you know, lovingly watching and, again, drawing attention away from the other woman. So they shared lovers. They fought over stories. They fought over plays. It just went on and on and on. But ultimately, it gets a little more interesting, and they influence each other. They both grow as artists in different ways. Eleanor Hughes starts to give press interviews, which she never wanted to do. She was a real artist. She thought all that mattered was what happened on stage. So this book is really rich. It's fascinating. They're both really interesting women, very strong characters. Sarah Bernhardt was sort of comical at a point for me, but she becomes a really interesting towards the end of the book. And it's really, you know, if you love theater, if you love acting at all, I think you'll really enjoy this book. And indeed, you could do a pretty campy and have a great season of Feud.
And does she ever say, I am big. It's the plays that got small.
Her plays were never small. Right. Sarah Bernhardt did plays. Lavish, you know, elephants on stage, anything, 400 costume changes. She spent her money. When you went to see her in a show, you got your money's worth.
Like Madonna.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of women, we have a woman who made our sexual misconduct news this week.
Yes, it's not good. Asia, is that how you say it? I thought it was Asia.
It's actually Asia, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Asia Argento, of course, was one of the many women who came forward to talk about Harvey Weinstein assaulting them, very famously so, speaking out at Cannes, I think, and other places.
Yes, in Cannes this year, she basically, you know, had the floor at the final awards ceremony and said, hey, I was raped at this festival in 1997 by Harvey Weinstein, and you know what? There are perpetrators that are still out there in this audience today. And you know who you are. And so it was a very powerful speech. And now
that's right. And
this.
Now she faces sexual misconduct allegations of her own. Apparently, when she was directing and starring in the film, what's it called? It's the film based on the J.T. Leroy scan, you know, one of his books. But she's directed and starred in a film. And this actor playing her son says that when he was 17 years old, she sexually assaulted him. And in fact, the New York Times says they have seen documents showing that he approached her threatening to sue after she came forward about Harvey Weinstein, and they paid him $380,000 essentially to go away. Now she may be booted from the X Factor Italy. Apparently she's a judge on X Factor in Italy. She's had a bad couple months. I mean, don't forget her boyfriend Anthony Bourdain sadly killed himself, and as if that wasn't bad enough, then people online start to harass her and say it was her fault. Bizarre, hateful comments. You know, when someone's dealing with somebody they know committing suicide, now we find out she faces sexual misconduct allegations of her own. They seem to have a lot of validity. The fact that people are sexually assaulted makes them more likely to sexually assault other people. That's not to, you know, a lot of people who are sexually assaulted don't ever hurt anyone else. It's not automatic. So it doesn't give anyone a free pass. But there's no surprise that if you are sexually assaulting someone, you'll often find that happened to them in their past as well. Sadly, that seemed to be one of the things that's going on here. It doesn't excuse her at all to say that she was assaulted herself. You shouldn't harm other people, even if you were harmed yourself. But it's a pattern you see all the time. You know, people who are sexually assaulted or raped for years, they end up becoming drug addicts, they become homeless, they become thieves. And then when they get to trial, people say, oh, you can't trust them. They're a drug addict and a homeless and a thief. Rather than saying, wow, maybe this is one of the things that happens when you get sexually assaulted. So it's an ugly, sad day. Sad to hear. Hopefully that actor in person has, you know, put their life back together. He said for years he had trouble. You know, he was very active before that assault. And afterwards, for years, you know, his income plummeted. Very sad to hear. You know, we'll have to see what happens here. But it's not a surprise that when people get screwed up, they screw up a lot of other parts of their life.
And Misunderstood, the film that she was working on?
The film was in 2004, and it was The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. I should say that's when she met him, and then it was years later, like 10 years later, when the sexual assault took place.
Look, I think it's on the front page of the New York Times, so obviously it's important news.
And it's a big deal is what you're trying to say, because it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
And our since this story, week, nothing happened. We'll just skip right ahead to inside baseball. No, we actually
we have
like
some big
two or three stories here. The Brits love their Victorian era movies and TV shows set amidst palaces and stately homes. And the Chinese people love the Qing Dynasty, yet another TV drama set in the fabled and fabulously wealthy world of the Forbidden City has become a TV rating smash. The story of Yangtze Palace is streaming now on the platform iQIYI, and unlike Netflix, that company is happy to share some ratings info. They drop two episodes a day, every single day, with the finale set to air on August 28th as viewers watch the adventures of a young woman who enters the palace to investigate her sister's death, and she rises from maid to concubine to the emperor himself. The story of Yangtze Palace will contain 70 episodes in all, so think of it as the Chinese equivalent of a telenovela. It's airing on TV in Hong Kong, Singapore, and some other territories, but most of the show's fans are online, probably being pirated, in fact. According to Straits Times, on Sunday, August 12th alone, the episodes racked up, get this, 530 million views.
One day, half a billion views in one day.
That's remarkable. In all, the series episodes have been viewed 5.6 billion times, or an average of 130 million views per episode. That's like the most popular television series ever. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. With a hefty budget of about $60 million, which is about $800,000 per episode, that's a good high-budget show for China. And they have about 770 million internet users. So I'm trying to compare that to North America. Let's say that's about double the size of North America's internet users.
Yeah.
I mean, that also is like
easily. It might be three or four times that amount.
Really? Four times?
Well, I mean, if you figure there's 300 million people in the U.S., and if you figure there's 200 million internet users because, you know, 50 million kids and, you know what I mean?
So 200 million to 200 million users. So that would mean, it would be like a movie in the U.S. reaching an average of each episode or averaging about 50 million viewers. So we've had shows like Game of Thrones, that's reaching like 30 million viewers, 25, 30 million viewers in North America. You can almost double that to say how big this show is proving in China. So that's a big, big hit. I don't see any notice about it coming here yet, but I'd love to check it out.
Just a few weeks after Drake landed all 25 of the songs from his new album on the Billboard Hot 100, artist Travis Scott has done the same. He has all 17 tracks from Astroworld logged onto the Hot 100. That goes nicely with his album sitting at number one on the Billboard Top 200. Only four other acts have done what Scott did. Drake, of course, along with Justin Bieber, The Weeknd, and Post Malone. Big deal or big whoop. And by the way, what do they all have in common?
That they've all had at least 17 tracks on the Hot 100 chart at the same time.
No, what I mean is besides that, what do they
They're all very new.
Right, exactly.
Right, exactly. And this is the point. It's a big deal because Billboard's methodology is broken. They have switched to a new system and it's screwing things up. It is making nonsense of the charts. Their chart is broken. They're not measuring some new remarkable dominance by these artists. You know, it's not like when the Beatles had five songs in the top five or the top 10. And you said, oh my God, that really meant something. Having 25 tracks on the Hot 100 just means his new album came out last week. That's wrong. It's not that Drake isn't big and Astroworld and Travis Scott aren't big, but the way they're balancing this and weighting it and letting them appear is screwy. It's not working right. And if a song has a billion views, that doesn't mean you say their album has gone triple platinum. And if an album is getting streamed, that doesn't mean you should pretend all their songs are on the Hot 100. They're really messing things up, and they really need to rethink what they're doing because they're making a hash of, you know, 100 years of Billboard chart history. And it's really confusing and it's not helping. Don't confuse hit singles with hit albums. Don't confuse streaming with album sales. You know, don't mess this up. They really need to come back and rethink what they're doing.
Team Coco, speaking of music, he's not on Team Music. Late night talk show host Conan O'Brien is switching to a half hour format this January. Interestingly, O'Brien insists this will give him more flexibility, not less. He'll do comedy and sketches and interview one celebrity instead of, say, three, and no musical guests, at least not every night. That's the big news, with O'Brien's booker moving on after 20 years with the host. That leaves only 874 TV shows looking to book acts once a week or more. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's why I think it's a big whoop. Not that Conan O'Brien isn't a lovely platform and it hasn't been able to bring attention to musical acts. Not that I can name a big act that he's broken, but there are so many late night slots that I don't think it's going to have an impact. I don't think it matters. I think his show is going to be his show and they'll be just fine. And the musical acts will have plenty of other places to go.
I wonder, I haven't watched Conan O'Brien in probably 5 years, easily.
I never watched him, but that may be just because you're old. You know, maybe young people are still watching him online or watching his clips. I don't know.
I don't know either. Sony is the latest record label to share the spoils of its sale of Spotify stock. Sony is distributing some $750 million in all, and unlike Warner Music, they are handing out the money free and clear, not using it to settle debt like money owed for promotional videos or album recording. The money goes to artists and affiliated labels, prorated based on their success over the past 10 years when Sony took its investment in the streaming service. The checks will arrive any day now, so we'll soon see if acts feel like they're getting a quote-unquote windfall or the usual digital pennies they see from royalties and the like. Only then will we know if this is a big deal or a big whoop. And by the way, there are real estate agents chomping at the bit right now. They're hovering like gnats waiting for those checks to fall. So let me know. What do you think?
You think it's going to be that big?
No, well, that's the joke. That's, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think this is, we just don't know yet. We'll have to see what money people actually get. And again, it's all voluntary. Or are they shamed into it? Are these labels now feeling like they have to do this to keep the peace with their acts? You know, they're all doing it now, it seems like. They're saying, well, we better share the money or we're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they're being, I mean, look, everybody knows Sony invested, right? So the question is, where's my share? Because, you know, if you're an artist, you can look and see how many times your music has been streamed. And you kind of go, okay, well, where's my money?
So they're just saying we're going to have to pay out. So we might as well do it on our own and not let them look at the books.
Right.
Right. And again, none of this changes the fact that they don't make enough money off royalties from Spotify and YouTube and all the others in the first place.
Correct.
I mean, you know, they still got, well, we got 80, 90, how many people now signed up around the world? We're going to have to like, what, have half a billion before they make money.
So Disney, they may have jumped the gun in dumping director James Gunn from the Guardians of the Galaxy 3 movie. You see what I did there? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Nonetheless, despite Gunn saying all the right words about his dismissal, despite the entire cast seeming to stand in solidarity with Gunn, and despite the media response being understanding of Disney, but feeling perhaps it was a little hasty, Disney is standing pat. They met with Gunn to say, "You're really not coming back to direct the next movie?" Mind you, they didn't fire James Gunn, the screenwriter, since they'll still be using his script. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I think it's probably the wrong decision. As vehement as I get on sexual misconduct stories, it seemed an overreaction to a right-wing attempt to take down a guy who was, you know, criticizing Trump, and he'd already apologized for all this stuff. And if Disney was really sincere about, we will not work with this person, it is unconscionable, then they wouldn't be dealing with his screenplay, would they? Then they'd say, well, we don't want that either because, you know what, it's tainted. If that's what they're saying, then why are they using his screenplay? So it's all just hypocrisy.
Right. Is he going to be, as the screenwriter, will he receive credit?
Of course he will. Absolutely.
And will he be invited to the premiere? Now, contractually, he is, you know, invited to the premiere.
Yeah, he may not want to go because it'll distract from the movie, perhaps. But yeah, no, exactly. But it's all hypocritical. And they've never said you're off the franchise forever. So you can imagine Guardians of the Galaxy 4, there's James Gunn again.
Yeah. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. You see, 3-4 quick, easy stories. It's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about publishing. And when we talk about the publishing industry, we are usually talking and looking at the trade market. Those are the books sold in bookstores, the latest Stephen King, and so on. But publishing is more than just trade. There's also the higher education market, i.e. college textbooks, or what I like to say is the books I'm still paying for, nearing 50 years old. The pre-K to 12 education market, as in school books, and professional publishing, including journals, trade papers, bulletins, and the like. And while trade has modestly righted itself financially, all the other segments are down in sales, sometimes considerably.
That's right. So if we're looking at the industry as a whole, and we're talking about the last 4 years, basically from 2014 to 2017, total sales of the entire publishing industry are down about 6%. That's the North American market, and it's about a $26 billion market right now as of 2017. The trade section, which is what you buy in bookstores, that actually rose about 3.4% in that period. But it's the other areas that are hurting. Higher education sales, those textbooks that you get in college, they dropped 18%. And then the school book market, the grade school and high school market, and the professional segment, those both dropped about 24%. So clearly, trade overall is the biggest market share, you know, by a significant margin. You know, if these things have dropped 24% and the whole industry is only down 6%, you can see how much of it depends on trade. That's where the biggest money is. But there's a lot going on in school textbooks at the grade school, high school, and college level, and the professional segment. And you can basically point it all to the internet.
What?
You know, well, yes, because there's a big movement, of course, for open share textbooks. Why are people buying new first grade, second grade, third grade, and fourth grade math books? Those aren't changing much. Why are they paying for them? They're switching to ebooks. They're switching to open share books. They're switching to, you know, stuff that's, you know, open and available and checked and done by educators, and they can just keep using them over and over again and not pay anybody. More and more states are demanding that their public universities and their grade schools and high schools adopt open source textbooks wherever possible. Second grade math doesn't change that much. 2 + 2 = 4. 4 + 4 = 8. Do you need a new fat textbook in hardcover? My niece is going to high school. She's a senior this year. They're giving out Chromebooks to everybody from 6th grade to 12th grade. A lot of kids already have their own laptop. They can deal with it. Kids who don't, they're getting a free Chromebook. Everybody can use the same one if they want. And they're going to have more and more texts available on that Chromebook 24 hours a day via the internet. So that's really, I think, where a lot of this turmoil is happening. That's why you're seeing drops of 24%, and I think it's just going to get worse.
Well, okay, so we're talking about ebooks and you know, hardbacks and paperbacks. Are there other formats that, I mean, I know audiobooks are a big thing now.
Well, that's right. When we're looking at formats, now again, we're talking about the trade book market. We're not talking about high school textbooks. We don't have breakdowns for that area because those sales wouldn't even be tracked by them because they're not sales. But when we look at the trade market, what people are buying at the stores, it turns out that ebooks have dropped significantly from 2014, which is probably the peak year. Right after that is when the publishers said, you know what? Let's raise the prices a lot. We'll charge you more for an ebook than for a hardcover. So that really hurt the market. Their share of the market has gone from 21% to 13%. It dropped by like 40%. That does not include self-published books available via Amazon. That just includes publishing books from like Simon & Schuster, Penguin Random House, things like that. But that format has taken a big hit. It's still true that new releases in the bestseller list, like a new Stephen King, a new John Grisham, most of those sales are ebooks. So don't write off the ebook yet. But in that format, ebook have taken a big hit. Audiobooks have risen a lot. They've tripled in size from 2% of the market to 6% of the market. And almost all of that is digital audio. It's now about a $1 billion market. It's like $940 million in sales last year. So digital audio alone, audiobooks alone in North America was a $1 billion market in 2017. It'll be that plus in 2018.
Maybe that's why Alexa keeps trying to, you know, read books to me every time I ask her a question. She's like, let me read you a story. Audible. I'm like, no, that's not what I asked.
Stop talking to me.
I said, what's the temperature outside?
You know, in 1874, Orson Welles wrote this. You know? Yeah, exactly. And the mass market is down to less than 5%. More audiobooks, it's a bigger share of the market than mass market. That's because they've strangled it in its crib. It was a great market for a long time. Publishers just don't make books available in mass market. All they want to do is sell you the far more expensive trade paperback. That's the larger size that's sort of nicer and sits on your shelf. And they say, oh, no, people want to pay $15 for a paperback. They don't want to pay $8 and have an ugly little mass market. That's really just like the airport rack now. That's where the mass market can be found. So that's less than 5% of the market. So, yeah, and where are sales happening? Well, online is about 40% of all sales.
That's wow.
Physical and ebook. So 40% of all sales are happening online, and I'm sure most of that is on Amazon. Amazon is the number one bookseller. It's the number one seller online. I wouldn't be surprised to hear like 80-90% of that is Amazon. I don't know if that includes used paperbacks, used sales, or anything like that. I think it's just new book sales. So that's what we're talking about. 40% is happening online. The rest is happening at bricks and mortars, grocery stores, Costco, things like that.
Well, publishing hasn't died off, and the ebook isn't.
No, publishing hasn't died off. Absolutely not.
Okay, well, yeah, I wasn't necessarily intimating that it was, but I was trying to move us on to talk about Aretha Franklin, who unfortunately did die last week at the age of 76. We mentioned last week that she was very, very ill, and indeed, after we recorded, she went into hospice, and she died of pancreatic cancer. And let's face it, I mean, there's not much we can say that hasn't been said over the past week about Aretha Franklin.
Well, she died at 76. It's not a thing that hits me hard because she had such a great full career and you felt like all her creative work was done. I mean, it's always sad when someone dies, but if when they're young or you feel like they're still producing great work, it kind of hurts you a little harder. And Aretha Franklin had a great career and I'm sure she would have kept recording and all that, but you know, she had done all her great work. So you felt like she had a full, complete life. The one thing I'll say that I thought about a little bit was how kind of cool it was to think on Monday or Tuesday when the news of her death spread. I could just imagine literally, like if you were out in space looking down on planet Earth, you would hear coming out of every speaker all over the world at the same time in South Africa, in Texas, in Iceland, in Brazil, all over the world. Suddenly people were playing Think and Respect, and you know, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You. It's kind of cool to imagine that music literally all at the same time, all of the world floating up into the air. Just all of that music, you know, whether a DJ played it, or you said, Alexa, play me this, or Siri, play me that. Suddenly, or you just chose it yourself on Spotify. I know, like people just like me, I was playing I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You and Lady Soul and her greatest hits, and I know that was happening all over the world. It's sad when someone dies, but it's kind of awesome to think of how celebratory it was and how everybody just started playing that music again and remembering how great she really was.
Well, and think about it. This is a performer who attended the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And then in 2009, okay, so that was in 1968. In 2009, she sang at the inauguration of Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah, no, that's very cool. No, she was a big civil rights figure. Certainly Think and Respect was more about women's rights, but Think was also, I mean, we sang that at the March on Washington for gay rights. I mean, that was what people, you know, different, not everybody all at once, but people were singing Think. People were leading people in that song about Think what you're trying to do to me, you know, asking for freedom and respect and equality. Her voice has really mattered to people for generations. So she's not just a pop singer that people liked. She really had an impact.
I know she'll be missed by many. But I guess that doesn't necessarily wrap up this show because we do have some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And this listener would like to remain anonymous, and we've kind of paraphrased this particular listener's email because it was lengthy. They write, hello guys, considering the success of the AMC's $20 monthly charge for movies, this question needs to be asked. Is AMC paying the distributor full price for all tickets sold, or are they discounting the tickets and as such discounting the percentage they pass on to the distributor of the film? In other words, the more films moviegoers see in a month, the less they charge for the ticket to ensure they do not lose out on the $20 charge. According to my understanding,
Let's answer that first question before we get to the rest of his letter. So do you think AMC is saying, all right, if you see four movies, I'm going to charge you $5 a movie rather than $8 or $10 or $12? Are they able to put that on a sliding scale and just decide on their own what to charge for each movie in North America?
No, they're not. They look at it as a ticket sold, okay? And if it's sold in, I don't know, let's say you're in Birmingham. If it's sold in Birmingham, Alabama, they will say that ticket would sell for $10.
Yeah.
And that is what we report to the studio, and the studio wants their percentage out of that amount.
Period. Roughly $5.
Roughly five. It depends on the film and the terms for that particular film.
Now, is that true all over the world? Because this letter does not come from the United States.
No, it is not true all over the world because, of course, different countries have different regulations about how movie tickets can be sold or what distributors can force exhibitors or movie theaters to sell tickets for. So in other parts of the world, it depends what country you're in. You know, Venezuela, maybe a bad example, but Venezuela has very strict regulations.
France has very strict rules.
UK as well.
And the UK. So the UK, we know that's the other big territory where studios are trying, the exhibitors, I should say, are trying a monthly flat rate. We don't have good numbers on how many people are participating or how many movies they're seeing a month, but we know there is a plan where, like, if you're in London, you can pay £22 a month and get access to, is it Cinepolis or Cineplex Odeon?
No, it's Odeon.
Odeon, it's Odeon, yeah.
Yeah, and Cineworld has their own, yeah.
Right, yeah. So Odeon has their plan in London and the rest of the UK. So it's, is it possible there they might be doing something like this?
I get the distinct impression that they are probably not working with distributors on this on that level, because it would be very difficult to get all six distributors to agree to certain terms. Okay. So really, they're just they're going the membership route, saying, well, you know, in some months we'll make money, other months we'll lose money, but we'll all make money on popcorn.
So. His next comment was, quote, according to my, I don't even know if it's a guy or a girl, but according to my understanding and according to the contracts for my cinemas, there is nothing stopping an exhibitor doing so. That may be true for their territory, but it's not true in North America. So they go on to say, this is a big question to be answered as it affects exhibitors and distributors greatly, especially if such a program becomes very popular. So what does he say in his final paragraph? He has some more questions to ask.
Well, they're saying that they're a cinema owner, but then they go on to say, also, what does this mean for smaller independent cinemas? Could this behavior be stopped on a chain level and only be permitted on a global level? If this did become a widespread marketing ploy, will it put non-chain locations out of business? Considering all this, is it likely the DOJ could ban this type of marketing, aka the monthly pass by AMC? If this did become a widespread marketing ploy, will it put non-chain locations out of business? Considering all this, is it likely the DOJ could ban this type of marketing, aka the monthly pass by AMC, as anti-competitive in the future?
That's the question. By global level, he means industry-wide for your territory. He doesn't mean worldwide.
Right, exactly.
So the question is, if this becomes successful, could it put non-chain locations out of business? What do you say to that?
If it becomes successful, it could put non-chain locations out of business depending on where they are. So Bowtie Cinemas, for instance, is in upstate New York. There are no AMCs in some of their locations. So would it put them out of business?
Well, but if the other big chain adopts it. So, I mean, there's more than one big chain. What's the second biggest chain?
Regal. And there are Regal locations in
right. So
in
if it works for AMC and Regal adopts it too, I'm not going to anyone but AMC. If I have to, you know, I'm going to go to AMC for any big movie playing in the chain. I'm not going to go to Regal. I'm not going to go to Cinepolis. I'm not going to go anywhere else.
Yes, it could definitely damage some of the smaller players. If there's circuits that are small and are in competitive markets.
Right, and face competition from a chain, correct. A big chain. Yeah, so it really could hurt them. So now with that said, is it likely the DOJ could ban it as anti-competitive?
Well, it's funny because there was a case in France where one of the major chains, I think it was CGR, and they had an unlimited subscription plan. Mm-hmm. And the other big chain, and I think it was Pathé, or maybe I'm getting those two circuits confused with one another, but they sued one another. Because of this, the one that didn't have the plan sued and said, this is anti-competitive. They can't do this. It's not fair. They lost that case. And of course, immediately then created their own subscription plan. So it's not really, there is no antitrust going on here. It's not really anti-competitive. They basically are saying we're willing to take a loss in hopes that, a membership will work and some months we'll make money on tickets and other months we won't. Some months we'll break even on tickets, but at the end of the day, we're really only taking a risk on the percentage of the ticket that we would own. And we're hoping that people will attend more often and purchase more concessions, which we will keep 100% of.
Mm-hmm. Or at least after the 2 cents it costs to make popcorn.
Correct.
So, yeah, you know, this is my problem. I'm thinking of, you know, switching from MoviePass to AMC. I'd much rather have an industry-wide MoviePass. You know, I'd much rather have something where I could go to more than one chain. I don't want to give all my business to AMC, and I want to go to those indie chains in New York. I want to go to the Quad. I want to go to Metrograph. I want to go to IFC. I just don't want to spend $15 a ticket to do so.
Now, would you be willing to pay $19 or $20 per month for industry-wide pass?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. In a heartbeat, especially in a major city. I would do that even in Alabama.
Right. And so would I, by the way. And so, for instance, this month, I've gone to see one movie. I went to see The Meg. Okay. It was like the only movie I could see that day. Now, that said,
was for $10 a month and you made money on it.
That was for, I paid $10 for the ticket. MoviePass paid $10 for the ticket. And of course, I paid them. Earlier. So I think my yearly subscription costs $90. So yeah, they're losing money on me every single month. What they're hoping is that I will continue to subscribe at $9 a month or $15 a month or whatever it winds up being when it's time.
MoviePass is $10 a month. It's going to go out of business. And you're just asking, would you pay $20 a month to have an industry-wide pass? And I would say yes, because I've shown I will go to 4 movies a month when I was able to go to Metrograph and Quad and IFC and the big movies. I went to 4 movies a month that would be absolutely worth $20 a month to me. I am debating getting rid of MoviePass because it's becoming ridiculous and it won't get me to any of the indie chains. My only question is there are 2 chains in New York, Cinepolis and Landmark at 57th Street. Those 2 have some indie films that won't be available at AMC. If I just go to 1 movie at those places that's not available at AMC, because I'm in New York, I will have saved money because I pay $10 a month for that card and the ticket would cost $15. So I would save money if I just went to 1 art film at those 2 theaters. And then for the rest of the time, will I go to 2 movies at AMC? Well, maybe. I went to 4 movies a month, so I'll go to 3. The only bummer is that I won't get to go to all the other art houses. So, you know, I'd much prefer an industry-wide. But here's AMC's thinking. They're saying, you know, they don't have to pay full price for a ticket. MoviePass has to pay $15 in New York. AMC only has to shovel over $7.50 to the distributor. We're just using a rough estimate of 50%. So if you pay them $20 for a monthly pass, if you go to 3 movies, AMC is only short $2.50, whereas MoviePass would have been short $45 minus 10, so they would have been short $35. So MoviePass loses $35 if you go to 3 movies. AMC loses $2.50. That's what they're in the red for. And AMC is obviously hoping you'll buy popcorn and soda. If you buy 1 soda, they're in the black.
Right, and if you buy 1 soda in those 3 times you go to the movies, right?
Which I won't, yeah, but yes.
But you think about it. They paid like 5 cents for that soda.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how much money they just made off of you.
Right. But here's what they're really doing. If AMC, if you're in a major market like New York or LA, and I go to 3 movies, that means AMC owes the studio, you know, $22.50. So they're down $2.50. If they don't offer a monthly pass and I just go to 1 movie, instead of being down $2.50, they are making $7.50. So it's a $10 change for each person. That's just 1 movie. So they are giving up that money, that income, which is a lot, because I'm not buying concessions, by the way. So they're thinking they can make it up on concessions as I just keep going to the movies. But that's a big change in money. From just 1 movie, they would make $7.50. That's a $10 increase in funding from what they go if I go to 3 movies on a MoviePass system.
But at the end, you know, for $20 a month for an industry-wide pass, again, what I was trying to drive at earlier is that I went to see The Meg earlier this month. We're almost at the end of the month. We've got 11 days left. I'm not going to see a movie tonight. I'm not going to see a movie tomorrow.
Well, they won't let you go see.
Even if they allowed me to see every single movie, I don't have the time, right, to see all of these movies or to go out on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. So for me, they would make money on me this month because I probably won't go see a second film this month.
But next month you'll go see 7 movies or something.
Or I'll go see 2 or 3, yeah.
Right. It's industry-wide. I've shown since November I will go to 4 movies a month at least, and I will continue to do that. So that's kind of what I think. The 3 million people who've signed up for MoviePass, if they sign up for AMC, they're going to make damn sure they go to 3 to 4 movies a month. There's no way they're going to. It's not like a gym membership where you benefit or feel good just owning it. You're like, oh, I've got a gym membership, I'm healthy. You know, there's no benefit. Unless you're a heavy user, you're not going to pay $20 a month for AMC.
Well, I did pay for MoviePass back when it was $25 when they first launched in 2012. And
there were 10,000 of you.
Well, yes, but what my point is that there were some months where, you know, God, I didn't see a movie this month. But next month I saw three movies and each one cost, you know, $15. So I was actually ahead for that month, which, you know, at the end, I counted it all out. I broke even.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, neither here nor there. I could have, right. I basically prepaid for tickets.
But you are a heavy user. I mean, most people don't go to that many movies a year.
No, not at all.
Right, so there you go. And most people don't watch the Oscars, at least not anymore, not the way they used to. And we talked about that last time, and we got a comment from one of our listeners. It's Takudza Madanha. Sorry about butchering your name. Yeah, give us a phonetic spelling next time so we can, or pay for my lessons in whatever language your name is from. But our listener Takudza wrote and said, quote, he's quoting what we sort of said on the show, quote, no one will start watching the Oscars if they start awarding movies that the vast majority of people actually like. Instead, let's strip the show to its bare bones and stick the sort of movies a select group of industry insiders like, end quote. This person says, I disagree with this line of thinking. They're saying, no, actually, if you give awards to the big movies that people actually enjoy, they might actually start watching instead of the obscure art films that most people never bother to see.
And what I would put in parentheses there, much like a dictionary would, see the Grammys.
Well, the Grammys often go to the big, big albums of the year.
That's what I mean. And their ratings are, you know, most of the time holding steady. This year they went down.
Yeah, they went down a little bit. I'd say for most of the Oscars history, every few years it did go to big popular movies. So this is a recent phenomenon, the idea that the big picture winner is never going to be the big movie of the year. I don't think that's true. I think it'll continue in the future. And I don't think a subcategory lesser will draw viewers. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but Takudza says I'm a fool. And, you know, he wouldn't be the first.
Well, thank you for listening to these fools for the last, even though there's no news, we still talk too much. You know, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free or aggregate podcasts. You can find us, rate, review the shows.
Rate and review the show. You know you haven't done it, for the love of God, please.
And it does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's We're Fools, But We're Not Motley Fools.com.
No idea what that's referencing.
The Motley Fools, they're like industry stock analyst people.
Oh, that's true. Okay, I know what you're
saying. Oh, is there a show next week?
Yes.
Yay, okay, great.
Okay, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to bookfilter.com to know what books you should be reading, or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.